Endocrine Feedback Loop is now free. Anyone can listen to it on our website, www.endocrine.org, or by searching for Endocrine Feedback Loop on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by the Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 48th episode and the final one of season four of the podcast. Today, we return to the JCENM to look at an article that details an approach of active surveillance as opposed to surgical intervention for individuals with malignant and suspicious thyroid nodules. In thyroid cancer management, there is an increasing interest in active surveillance, but not yet as much data as we would like to have. So this type of information will greatly benefit our clinical care. As with all of the observational studies we review, we will try to highlight the challenges of such investigations and the associated limitations of the conclusions we draw. I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop and spend most of my time working at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center as a general endocrinologist and medical director. Here in our virtual recording studio in his first stint as a regular contributor is Anupam Kuntwal from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. There, he focuses his clinical care and research on endocrine oncology, especially thyroid cancer, with a research emphasis on immune biomarkers for thyroid cancer. Joining us today as our guest expert is another thyroid cancer specialist, Megan Haymart. She comes to us from the University of Michigan and is internationally known for her expertise in thyroid cancer. She serves on multiple guideline committees for thyroid cancer and conducts research on optimizing the delivery of thyroid cancer care and assessing the overdiagnosis and overtreatment of thyroid cancer. So, as is usual for us, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to review an article on thyroid cancer. As is also always the case, everything we say will be our opinion only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For today's episode, we discuss non-operative active surveillance of larger malignant and suspicious thyroid nodules, which is a forthcoming article from the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Benjamin Alt-Schuler and Athanasios Bikas serve as the first authors for this paper, which came to us from the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School in Boston. Now, I will hand the conversation over to Anupam. He will highlight the main points that the authors make in their introduction and get Megan to unpack some key concepts in thyroid cancer that we need to keep in mind in order to understand these results. Anupam?
Thank you, Chase, for that introduction. So I will start off with just some general epidemiology of thyroid cancer. And we know that there's been a rising incidence of thyroid cancer, low risk as well as sometimes high risk disease over the past 30 years. So I would like to ask Megan's input on why she thinks this could be occurring.
Hi, thanks for having me today. Yeah, so for at least 30 years, there's been this rise in thyroid cancer incidence. Most recently, it's plateaued a little bit. This is an issue that especially affects women. So, you know, about 75% of all thyroid cancer cases are in women. Overwhelmingly, it appears to be a story of overdiagnosis. So we know that there's been increased use of neck ultrasound, which has led to this rise in thyroid cancer. There's great data from the US, from South Korea, from other countries as well. Suggesting again that it's related to overdiagnosis. But it is quite possible that there's another element as well, especially as you mentioned, since then there's been this increase in high-risk disease as well, a small increase, not as marketed as in low-risk disease. But it's possible that not only is there overdiagnosis, but there could be some sort of environmental exposure or another factor such as obesity that is contributing to this rise in incidence. And again, it's risen. Most recently, it's plateaued, but it's still a concern as far as, you know, why this has occurred. And especially since it's a common cancer in young adults, and again, a common cancer in women.
So once the thyroid cancer is diagnosed and treated, usually differentiated thyroid cancer will have a fairly reassuring prognosis, usually localized cancer will be indolent, especially if it's small and has not metastasized either to the lymph nodes or the lungs or distant sites. This has then led to change in the management paradigm in that small thyroid nodules can be monitored, or if they are less than 1 centimeter thyroid cancer, such as micro PTC, they could be monitored or undergo active surveillance as well. At the same time, slightly larger thyroid nodules that turn out to be cancer and are localized could have less aggressive surgery, We've also had changes in selectivity of radioactive iodine treatment. So I would like to ask Megan to maybe elaborate a little bit on some of these potential side effects from either the surgical treatment that patients may undergo, as well as some of the complications from radioactive iodine. And how does that play into us potentially overtreating patients who may have otherwise a fairly indolent course from a thyroid cancer?
So many years ago, it was a one-size-fits-all approach for thyroid cancer. And so, you know, everybody got a total thyroidectomy. Everyone with differentiated thyroid cancer got radioactive iodine. Virtually everyone got suppressive doses of levothyroxine. But then what we realized is our patients do well, many times regardless of treatment. And we know that there's this large reservoir of indolent disease. Sometimes we have trouble differentiating who has more indolent disease versus aggressive, but other times it can be more apparent. And so that's when there began this push of, could we do less? And so there's this push of, could we do less in regards to just doing lobectomy instead of total thyroidectomy? Could we do less in regards to no radioactive iodine as opposed to radioactive iodine? Could we do less in regards to less thyroid hormone and TSH suppression? So high doses of thyroid hormone to suppress the TSH. Part of the reason was, is we didn't want to cause harm. And so total thyroidectomy, many times patients do fantastic. But there is a risk of hypoparathyroidism, which can lead to low calcium. Sometimes this can be chronic. Patients can have to take multiple meds. They can even end up in the hospital for this. There's a risk of recurrent laryngeal nerve damage, which can cause like a very hoarse, gruff voice, which can be troubling for patients both personally and professionally. We know that there's risk from radioactive iodine. Not uncommonly, we'll see salivary gland swelling, dry mouth, increased risk for cavities. We'll sometimes see issues with the lacrimal duct where patients will have tearing or dry eyes. And then there's a very small risk of second and primary malignancies. So because some of these treatments have risk, and because there are some patients who would do well regardless, there's been this shift in regards to trying to find out which patients can do well with less intensive treatment. And so it's a fine line of what's the perfect balance. And I think that we're making headway, but still trying to sort of figure out what's optimal.
So with that information, as we know, differentiated thyroid cancer that's less than 1 centimeter, there have been studies looking at outcomes from active surveillance. But then now we're pushing the envelope a little. We're extending that size to larger than 1 centimeter thyroid cancer that's localized in the thyroid. And there has been some interest in that field, especially given some of the complications of treatment. So this is where we come to this current study. And so I will let Chase take over some of the discussion regarding the methods of the study.
Anupam, thank you, and Megan as well. So again, really nicely sets things up here. So we have a good understanding. We reason to think active surveillance is going to make sense for a lot of folks. We have some data for smaller cancers. And now the obvious question, well, how far can we push that? Well, how big can we go here? So a lot of interest in that. And I think this is going to help us at least think about that a little bit more. What we typically do when we move into the methods is think about an observational study design when that's the case. And the way I would describe what the authors do here, it doesn't fit terribly well into any classic study design. So it's hard for me to say that, oh, this is a cohort study or cross-sectional study. So I don't know that we have any easy shortcuts as far as understanding what the authors do here. But important to note that it is observational. We'll get into that as we go along the way to figure out why that makes a difference. And so let's just start with the source of the patient. So the first thing to talk about in this study is where these patients are coming from. The authors, actually, it's in their introduction, but they describe the nodule clinic that operates at the Brigham. And the way that they described it, it's designed in their center to be the place where all patients with a thyroid nodule throughout the academic medical center are referred. And one of the comments that the authors make as they describe that is saying this really helps because this potentially reduces sampling bias. So to elaborate on that, because I think that's important to understand. The sampling bias, it refers to when you are collecting your patients that are going to be in a study. And if the way that you select them does not well represent the population at large, then you get worried about trying to generalize those results because of the way that you have sampled them. And since the authors bring that up, I would say that is a potential strength of studies that would be based in a nodule clinic where nearly all patients at a center are going. I would say, though, that that's true only if you are using all of the patients that are in your center as your patient base. if you are using a much smaller set that have been selected for some other reason, you really lose a lot of that. We'll see that as we go along, as this is a very select group. So I'm not sure that really we can say that a strength of this study is going to be a lack of a sampling bias or reduction in that, but certainly would have that possibility with studies at large in this center. So the way that these specific patients were selected to be a part of this investigation is the authors identified all patients who underwent active surveillance of suspicious or malignant thyroid nodule, about a 20-year period, so 2001 to 2021. And again, this becomes highly selective at this point because you're getting a relatively small subset of folks and raises the question of, well, how did they get into this group? How did they decide that they wanted to do active surveillance? Was it the patients who were driving this? Was there something about their comorbidities or even potentially a provider interest or willingness to do this? So we don't understand that very well here, but it does make it a selective group. But as a comment about what would count here, so for you to have a nodule that was considered suspicious or malignant, so you had to have a Bethesda 5 or 6, or if you underwent a Afirma molecular test, it had to have a suspicious result on that. And you had to have data for at least a year. So you had to have been followed for a full 12 months to be able to be considered to have undergone active surveillance for at least a period of time. In terms of the data that was collected, a lot of the usual stuff that you would expect. So there was demographic data, clinical data, ultrasound information, and pathology data. And then the duration of active surveillance that was defined as the period of time from that initial ultrasound and FNA all the way up to the final ultrasound that was done as a part of the patient's monitoring. Where I'd like to go now is I'd like to get input from Megan and Anupam, and we'll start with Megan, but I'm curious as to what other information we might like to know. As always, as a reminder, with these observational studies, you are typically limited to what is available to you if this is a retrospective study, so you are not defining this up front. So if it's not in the chart, it may not be available, so we may wish for a lot of things that just simply weren't there. One thing at least that popped out in my mind as I was reading this is curious as to why patients ended active surveillance, and we're not really sure why they started it in the first place. But then also why they ended it. We'll talk about it in the discussion. There's certainly a lot of anxiety, other issues that go along with it. So it'd make you wonder how much that was a component, but we don't really know that here. But Megan, let's start with you. Anything else that as you looked at this data that you wish had been available or if the authors had included?
I was very curious how these patients differed from the patients that didn't undergo active surveillance. Were they patients with more comorbidities? Were they certain, you know, within a certain age group? And I think that's really important. One, clinically, it might give us some idea of what context active surveillance might be appealing to patients. But two, it introduces that issue of selection bias. Like, could there be selection bias in who decided to participate in active surveillance? Or even, was one physician more likely to offer active surveillance? And could that lead to selection bias? So I was very interested in that. Another thing, which you hit on a little bit, is I'm very curious about the worry and anxiety that goes with active surveillance. I think traditionally, we think that there's going to be more worry and anxiety. Some of the data to date hasn't shown that. It may just be that patients worry about different things if they're undergoing active surveillance versus if they underwent surgery and radioactive iodine treatment, let's say. But I was very interested in how this cohort, how bad was worry and anxiety and distress? And, you know, like what you mentioned, did that lead to patients deciding on having surgery later?
Anupam, any thoughts on that? Other data or information that you wish would have been included in this report?
Yeah, I completely agree with the points both of you raised about some additional data. The one other thing I could think of would be molecular alteration data. So especially in the cases that were GSC or Afirma suspicious from the molecular test, would have been useful to know maybe if there was any other high-risk mutations or alterations that were seen that could provide some more information. But then I do think the most important one is, why did these people choose not to undergo surgery initially, or why did they choose really to undergo surgery later, more than some of the information that's already been given?
Thanks, Anupam. I like that you mentioned that question about some of the details of the molecular testing. We'll come back to that. It'll be a time for speculation at the end of our discussion, but we will circle back to that here in just a few minutes. A couple of final comments here on the method. So as far as exclusions go, so if you didn't have ultrasound and pathology data, you were excluded for that reason. And then also if you had known metastatic disease, so this was not looking at that group, this is looking at folks who were not known to have metastatic disease. So if you were known, you were not included. And then the outcomes that were looked at, the interest here was around disease-specific mortality, around new metastases or nodule growth, and a typical definition there, either 50% increase in volume or a greater than 20% increase in diameter in at least two dimensions. Okay, so there's a quick overview of the methodology. We're going to turn it over to Anupam now, and he'll pick back up and walk us through the results as the authors present them.
So the study included 69 patients, and the average age was 62 years. 81% females were included. And the cytology here, so 33% had Bethesda 5, 21% were Bethesda 6, and 46% of patients had an indeterminate thyroid cytology, but with a suspicious Afirma result. And in terms of sizes, so about half or 45% had a nodule less than 1.5 centimeter, 36% had nodules between 1.5 to 3 centimeter, and a small proportion, 19%, had a nodule that was larger than 3 centimeter. Just to point out that 16% of the nodules were less than a centimeter that were also included. These patients were followed for a mean or average of about 55 months. Again, the shortest follow-up had to be at least a year since the initial diagnosis. As far as the overall outcomes, there were no thyroid cancer-related deaths, so no disease-specific mortality. Along with that, there was no cases of metastases either to the neck lymph nodes or outside of the neck, such as distant metastases. The authors do describe one case where the patient had a poor differentiation of thyroid cancer over approximately 17 years, had been lost to follow-up a few times, had a positive BRAF V600E mutation, and refused surgery at both times. So that's the information we have. We can discuss it a little in the discussion part. Now, looking at the tumor growth, they looked at both a 3 millimeter increase as well as a 5 millimeter increase, and kind of corresponding to that, a 50% volume increase or 100% volume increase. So there's quite a few numbers here, but to synthesize it, 21% of nodules had a 3 millimeter or more increase, which corresponds to about 1/4 of the nodules having a more than 50% volume increase. And when they followed these patients over 1 through 5 years, the percentages kept increasing slowly with time. For example, about 33.5% had a 3 millimeter increase in dimensions at 5 years. The significant increase, which is attributed to a more than 5 millimeter, occurred in 14% overall. Correspondingly, 100% volume increase occurred in 13%. So similar numbers there. Again, over a period of 1 through 5 years, the frequency increases slowly. Then the authors looked at delayed rescue surgery. This occurred in 13 out of 69 patients. So 19%. But interestingly, only 30% of these cases had a growth in nodule. So some other reason to consider surgery at that time. About 70% had a thyroid cancer diagnosis being differentiated thyroid cancer. 23% were benign. And there was one case of NIFB. When they looked at factors that were associated with delayed rescue surgery, younger age, so age of 52, mean versus 65 was more likely to be associated with patient undergoing rescue surgery, and actually a smaller nodule size, so 1.3 centimeter, more in the delayed rescue surgery group versus a size of 2.3 centimeter in the group that did not undergo rescue surgery. Most of the nodules that underwent surgery were 1 to 2 centimeter, so 77% of these nodules. Interestingly, at least in this study, there was no association between the patient undergoing delayed rescue surgery and their initial cytology, whether it was based on the Bethesda classification or Afirma. As far as surgical risk and complications, fortunately, there was no cases of permanent hypoparathyroidism or recurrent laryngeal nerve paralysis. One patient did have a vocal cord weakness that was temporary and improved. And then the authors did look at a subgroup analysis based on the initial cytology and molecular status. Overall, in this surveillance cohort, the Bethesda 6 nodules were smaller than the rest of the cohort, which would make sense. And when they looked at a tumor volume increase more than 50%, 28% of Bethesda 6 nodules had this increase, and there was no statistically significant difference between whether the patient had a Bethesda 6 nodule or Bethesda 5 or an indeterminate nodule with Afirma being suspicious. So in this study, tumor size or a younger age were not associated with the risk of nodule growth. And similarly, the type of cytology was also not associated with the risk or the frequency of nodule growth more than 50% in volume.
All right, thank you, Anupam. And we'll move into the discussion here. And in a second, I will quote how the author summarized the results. So I'll say, based on the results that Anupam just walked us through, similar to what Megan suggested in the introduction, is that our patients seem to do relatively well no matter what. And on the whole, these folks did relatively well. So that then leads the authors to summarize, and I'll quote them here, is that some thyroid malignancies measuring between 1 and 4 centimeters meeting criteria for surgical resection without high-risk features or signs of local spread on ultrasound may be reasonable candidates for non-operative management. And to highlight some key points here, the authors also point out that in around 5 years of active surveillance, that there was no disease-specific mortality and no local lymph node metastatic spread. They do point out that nodule growth was common, though only about 15% grew what would be considered rapidly. And at this point, the authors move on, as is fairly typical here, to review other data. We talked about this already in their introduction, as there's not a lot of data specifically looking in this situation, but they do go through the data on active surveillance, which is primarily for nodules that are under a centimeter in diameter. So this is where I'm really interested in getting Megan's input. She thinks about this a lot and has lots of expertise here. So one, Megan, I'm wondering if you could just summarize some of that data. The authors go through it at length, but if you can hit the highlights of that for us. But another thing that as a second question for this, and we can get through this afterwards, but really interested in contrasting this to some other data. And Anupam actually pointed this out as we were doing our preparation for this review. Is that JCNM also published an article back last year, which we reviewed on this podcast in the November 2023 episode, that actually concluded that a surgical delay in low-risk patients might actually impact outcomes in a negative fashion. So just put those couple things together for us, if you will, and help us understand what else is out there in the literature and how that affects how we should think about these results.
Yeah, so one of the things I liked about this study was the fact that they did include Bethesda 5, and they did include individuals who had, you know, positive molecular testing that suggested that it was suspicious. So I thought that was nice, right? Instead of just focusing on patients with known papillary thyroid cancer. So I thought it sort of broadened it, made it more clinically relevant. When we look at the prior data, there was a great systematic review by Roger Chow. He worked with the American Thyroid Association guideline writing group, so this will likely influence the guidelines that will be coming out. And he did a systematic review of existing studies at the time. This was published in 2022 in Thyroid. And the majority of those studies focused on individuals with cancers less than 1 centimeter. But even then, the quality of data wasn't great. So there was like one FAIR study and then many studies with poor quality, many case series instead of more high quality study designs. Looking at that data, taking into account that there are some limitations, you still saw this pattern of the fact that patients appear to do well with active surveillance. Outcomes appear to be similar to patients who have surgery. And so again, most of those studies focused on cancers less than a centimeter. At that time in 2022, there were only a few studies that were starting to focus on larger cancers. Since then, there's been a few more. And you sort of see the same pattern similar to this. It appears that most patients do well. It appears that it's reasonable. But again, we still have that issue with the fact that the study design is often not as ideal as we'd like. The sample sizes are often smaller than what we'd like to see. And then we do, you know, in those studies as well as this one, occasionally get things that make us a little concerned, like the one patient who the cancer became more dedifferentiated. And so, you know, I think this sort of complements the existing work. You know, it really does suggest that there's a role for active surveillance. But it also suggests that we have to think carefully about, you know, which patients this may be appropriate for. And so that's why I was curious about one who chose it. Was it patients with comorbidities or, you know, were certain age groups more likely to choose it? Because if you think of, you know, some of our patients are young, they're in their 30s, you're going to follow them for a long time. You know, this idea of someone having an event 17 years later might be more concerning versus if someone's older, they have a lot of comorbidities, they have other medical issues that they're dealing with. Maybe that would be a patient or, you know, maybe the patient's clinician would be more comfortable with active surveillance. So I think this complements a lot of the existing work, but still suggests that there's more work to be done.
And help us understand. So again, back on that article, the previous article from the JCNM that suggests that maybe surgical delay can actually have a negative impact on outcomes, which is, while not trying to answer the exact same question, does overlap depending on how you think about that. So help us understand that seeming discrepancy.
Yeah, so that study, you know, is a very large study. So it was SEER Medicare. So it did have a large N, but it only had a small percent who had surgery delayed, you know, so it's like 2.5% that had surgery delayed greater than 180 days. And so one of the issues that came up with that study, you know, and there were some commentaries, is because that percent was small, you know, was there some sort of selection bias with who those individuals were? Like, meaning, did they do worse because that was really just a marker of individuals who weren't getting high quality care? Most of us assume that our patients with low-risk disease can postpone their surgery and do well. Most of this data with active surveillance suggests that postponing surgery is fine. Maybe we're not comfortable following for 17 years, as there's always some outliers. But I do think there is a little bit of a conflict with that prior studies, but there's a limitation with that study in regards to the fact that there was a small proportion and could it have been selection bias. And there's limitations with this study in regards to the fact that there's a small cohort and could there in fact be selection bias. So I think that, again, further investigation needed.
Megan, you touched on a couple of times already that we really need to be careful when we're thinking about which patients are going to be appropriate for this. The authors go on in their discussion to point out that anxiety could be an issue, and that can go along with both the diagnosis of thyroid cancer, but then also as an ongoing issue with active surveillance. And so I think that could also play into trying to choose the right folks to undergo active surveillance. So help us understand that a little bit more. You alluded to it in the introduction, but why is that an issue, and what do we know about that?
We know in general that worry in our thyroid cancer patients is high. So there's been a lot of data to support this. And we think there's many reasons. One is that it's a cancer that affects a lot of young adults. So it's the most common cancer in individuals age 16 to 33. These are people that are going through transitions in their life related to school, related to work, related to family. Maybe their peers are healthy, and then they get a cancer diagnosis. And so that can be very troubling. And just for people in general getting a cancer diagnosis. So we know at baseline that worry and anxiety can be high. We as clinicians sometimes think that maybe active surveillance would lead to more worry, that maybe patients would feel better just to get it out. And that may be the circumstance in some situations. But again, there's some data that suggests that people are going to worry. You know, they might just worry about different things. And it may be that active surveillance causes less worry for some individuals and more worry for others. And so I really think that that's an important component that has to be evaluated when determining if active surveillance is right for your patient.
Back to this paper, the authors touch on, again, the surgical risks that go along with thyroidectomies. And they also point out that several studies have shown that active surveillance is actually a cost-effective approach, even if it goes on for prolonged periods of time. Some limitations that are pointed out by the authors, they mention, as we did already, that this included both suspicious and malignant disease. So depending on how you view that, could be either a strength or a limitation of their report. And as Megan just mentioned, a relatively small study here. So they wrap up with a couple of concluding statements, and then I'll quote them here. First of all, the authors state that the study supports consideration of a more permissive strategy for thyroid cancer management, including broadening the current patient pool that are eligible for consideration of active surveillance. And then finally, further prospective trials are needed to provide conclusive understanding of the risks and benefits. So now I want us to move into giving more of our own thoughts here. So before we get into whether this would change our practice, I want to just think about the quality of the report overall. So Anupam, why don't you give us your thoughts? What was your impression just about how well constructed this report was?
Again, this is a difficult group to get enough numbers to do an analysis. Kind of comparing this to either a case control or a cohort study, I think the quality is more on the moderate side. It's not a very high quality study design. It's not a randomized study where similar patients would have been randomized either to undergo active surveillance or more immediate upfront surgery. That is definitely a limitation. But with that strength that comes with that is it's more real world. It's more what we would see in the clinic. And patients may choose one or the other for other reasons, which we will not be able to find out in a randomized study. A limitation there, but of course some benefit, making it slightly closer to real-world clinical practice. And then some of the lack of mention of reasons for pursuing surveillance or monitoring versus surgery. Again, based on the way it's written, it is possible that some of these patients actually did not follow up. So it may not be a very close surveillance cohort either. These may be patients who just didn't follow up irrespective of the recommendations and then came back later, especially that one case that had progression. So there are some of these concerns, but that would be my thought on the quality here.
Yeah, thanks for pointing out the idea of clinical trials here. So we will think about that more here in just a second and the challenges that would be baked into that. But Megan, before we do that, why don't you just give us your thoughts? You mentioned some thoughts already just about the inclusion and your thoughts on the different types of nodules that were included here. But what are your thoughts in addition to that on the quality of this report?
I really like the novelty, again, of like focusing on not just Bethesda 6, but including Bethesda 5 and including individuals who had molecular testing that was suspicious. So I thought that was innovative. And so I like that innovative component. I did like the length of follow-up, you know, so this is tricky, right, to do these studies. And even when we start to think about trials, you know, having long enough to follow these patients. So I thought that the length was adequate. I thought the limitations were, you know, the sample size was relatively small. And then I had some major concern about selection bias, just who are these people that are choosing to do it versus the individuals that didn't. And so I think it would have been nice to see some information on the individuals who chose not to do active surveillance and how did they differ from this cohort. So I think it complements some of the existing studies, but I think there's still a lot more that could be done.
All right, Anupam, so you said something about clinical trials. The authors themselves suggested that prospective trials are going to be needed to better understand this. So why don't you give us your thoughts? So you see thyroid cancer patients a lot. You probably think about this a lot, maybe get asked about this fairly frequently. So is this report going to change your practice? So do you think this gives you more information when you're seeing a patient with a suspicious nodule or one that has actual cytology that indicates malignancy, but it's over a centimeter in size? Are you going to feel more comfortable changing your practice at all, or you're going to sit tight until we get more clinical information?
This will change some practice. This study, as well as a few other studies that looked at up to 1.2, 1.5, and then up to 2 centimeter nodules, which was one of the randomized trials. So definitely, I would say there will be more comfort, both from the provider standpoint and hopefully the patient standpoint, in offering active surveillance. But we do need to evaluate for other factors. We need to incorporate the patient's preferences, worry, ability to follow up. What other comorbidities do they have? So if there are major comorbidities that limit their, especially 5 and 10 year survival, maybe we would choose more on the surveillance standpoint versus patients who are much younger. Whereas it is, we saw in this study that the younger age did have a higher likelihood of actually undergoing rescue surgery, even though not a lot of nodules increased in size. So it may be that some of that rescue surgery may have been from just either worry or being fed up of following up this closely or some other factor that we don't know. And then keeping in mind access to infrastructure and high volume surgeons and access to high volume centers where monitoring and can be done. So all the studies that this one, as well as the others, are all done at tertiary and quaternary care cancer centers, but we may not be able to incorporate some of these monitoring and surveillance outside of those centers in community practices or resource poor areas. So it's something that also needs to be kept in mind because that may limit our ability to monitor these patients appropriately and offer them the active surveillance. But I do think the study adds to this foundation of further work in this field and does give at least me a little bit more information in being able to offer active surveillance, especially for people who have other comorbidities and the nodules are still, or the cancers are still localized in the thyroid, and kind of just adds more approaches to what we could offer to the patient.
So Megan, let's get your thoughts. And I think particularly interested in hearing, so or should we start changing what we're doing now, or do we need to wait for more data, knowing that it's going to be really hard and something that actually has a fairly low mortality regardless, that it's going to be hard to do a big, long study that would actually be able to show us clear distinction here if we're thinking about an RCT. So what are your thoughts? Do we start changing things now, or no, we really do need to sit tight and actually get clinical trial data?
For me, this study plus the other studies make pretty comfortable with delayed surgery, right? I think there's pretty strong data that for the majority of these patients, you know, if they need to delay for another cancer treatment, if they need to delay because they have a wedding coming up that they, you know, don't want to have a scar for, I'm feeling pretty comfortable with that. I run into the issue of how long to follow these individuals and sort of, as Anupam said, the concern about loss to follow up with time. That's where I sort of struggle a little bit more. You know, young patients, patients who might move, you know, patients who may not be compliant, like how long are we going to follow them? And I think, you know, for active surveillance, you have to have the patient buy-in, you know, so the patient has to be interested. You have to have the physician buy-in, which we know that there's variability in how many physicians are interested in providing this. And then, as Anupam alluded to, you have to have the infrastructure for it. And so that's, you know, where it gets a little bit complicated. So you have to have physicians that are comfortable doing neck ultrasound, are comfortable, you know, following up with these patients. And that doesn't exist everywhere. So I think that there's clearly a role for active surveillance. And I think we're at a stage where people might be using it differently, you know, so maybe there's not consistency with how everybody would use it. But I do agree with you. It's really hard to do a prospective or randomized controlled trial because you need, you know, NIH funds, they're usually for 5 years. And, you know, by the time you get started, you're going to have what, maximum of 3 years of follow-up on somebody. So it's going to be very hard to sort of design something. I think we're going to be, you know, still limited for many years to systematic reviews that pool many of these types of studies.
And then, Megan, one final follow-up question for you, and this is deviating fairly far from this article itself, but I think a question that gets asked a lot. Firma was used here, some molecular markers, and that was really just to distinguish whether a pathology is likely to show this is a cancer or no, it's not a cancer. And I think the field at least seems to be evolving to really trying to answer the question of not, is this a cancer or not, but is this going to be an aggressive one? Meaning, is this one that's going to actually spread outside of the thyroid? Is it going to metastasize either locally or distantly? So help us understand that. Do you think maybe in the future, that's the question that we're trying to answer is not, do you have a cancer, but do you have an aggressive cancer? And what might that look like as we're trying to decide whether somebody can be actively surveilled or whether they actually need surgical intervention?
As you know, in the past 10 years, like molecular testing for thyroid cancer has just sort of blown up. You know, it's fantastic that it's available. It really makes a difference for high-risk patients who we know have advanced disease and then they have a certain mutation that may be targetable. We struggle a little bit in how to use molecular testing for our lower-risk patients, meaning we're not yet endorsing that everybody should get it. So it's different if someone has atypia and you get a Firma and then they come right back and they also tell you they have a BRAF mutation. That's sort of bonus information that you got, but we're not sort of universally saying that everybody should have, like, let's say BRAF testing. And so I think that we're not there yet as far as for all comers, that molecular testing is uniformly like shaping how we make decisions about surgery. We're definitely there for advanced thyroid cancer, the way we moved forward in regard to molecular testing and knowing actionable mutations has really improved care. I do think that's the goal, but we're just not there yet. And it may be that it's simpler than that. So it may be that there's certain patients that we can exclude without getting molecular testing and maybe others who do need it.
And with that, I would like to thank Anupam Kotwal and Megan Haymart for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you by the Endocrine Society with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon. If you want to like and subscribe, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear your feedback on this episode or the podcast itself. Please email us at podcast@endocrine.org.
Endocrine Feedback Loop is a free service of the Endocrine Society. To learn more or to become a member, visit the Society's website at www.endocrine.org.